KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, August 25th, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Ted Kooser, Poet Laureate of the United States. He'll speak about his first year as U.S. Poet Laureate. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Doug Roseman, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Our speaker will take your questions following his talk, and we have put paper and pencils on the table. So please jot down whatever you would like to ask, and they will be collected by Mr. Gary Kerr and brought to me here. I will then read the questions, as we only have one microphone. Mr. Kooser will answer if he chooses to do so. Mr. Kooser has generously consented to sign his books following the question and answer session. And some of his books are here available for purchase, so feel free to purchase the books over there. Those are the ground rules, so let us begin our program. Today, I am deeply honored to be able to introduce to you Mr. Ted Kooser. There is so much I could tell you about this gentleman, but unfortunately my time is limited. However, I will talk fast. So, for example, he was born in Ames, Iowa. He and his wife, Kathleen Rutledge, live near Garland, Nebraska. Kathleen is editor at the Lincoln Star Journal. So obviously, writing runs in the family. He is a retired life insurance executive. He teaches poetry and nonfiction writing as a professor at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and he is on the faculty for the Nebraska Summer Writers Conference. He is the author of 11 collections of poetry and prose. His published works have appeared in numerous periodicals, and his works have been given numerous awards and honors that are basically too numerous to mention here, but I want to point out his book, Delights and Shadows, was awarded this year's Pulitzer Prize for poetry. And in 2004, he was appointed the 13th, and this is the official title, Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry to the Library of Congress. And this past year, his appointment was extended for another year. He is the first person from the Great Plains area to hold this distinguished post, or as Publishers Weekly magazine referred to him, he's the first major poetic voice for rural and small town America to be chosen. A true innovator, he created a syndicated weekly newspaper column, American Life in Poetry, to reintroduce poetry to America's newspapers. Funded and supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, you can learn more about this project at www.poetryfoundation.org on the internet. So from his book, The Poetry Home Repair Manual, which I highly recommend to aspiring poets, Mr. Kooser tells us, poetry is communication, and poetry's purpose is to reach other people and to touch their hearts. Another great writer, poet, Robert Frost, said, poetry is when an emotion has found its thought, and the thought has found words. Ted Kooser's thoughts have found words very well. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Ted Kooser, who will tell us what it's like to experience a year as the Poet Laureate.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you all for coming. Can you hear me in the back? Rod? Some of you have heard me tell this story before, but I always like to begin my talks with this story. A person can get tremendously puffed up about being named Poet Laureate of the United States, and as you might expect. And shortly after I was named, there was a lot of press coverage, and the Los Angeles Times ran a big story and with a mugshot of me in the middle of it. And one of my old friends, Tom McCowan, who lives in Los Angeles, was showing this article to a six-year-old boy. And a friend of his and read the article to him and then went over it and said, well, you know, the Poet Laureate might do this and might do that and so on. And he finally said to the little boy, he said, so what do you think? And the little boy said, I think he looks like a hobbit. And then, like he came from Middle Earth, which is really, you know, where we are here, you know. So, but anyway, that was great fun, and I've had some other experiences like that. I did a reading at the Lead Center. There were a lot of people there, and I had a letter from a fifth grader who said, "Dear Mr. Kuser, I don't like poetry, but I attended your event at the Lead Center, and my friend Eric was there, which made it all right." So there's been a lot of that. And I have a new poem I'm going to read today. You'll find me rambling around here today. I didn't really prepare anything on paper. I felt that what I wanted to do mostly was hear from you and hear questions and so on after a little bit here. But people have been asking me how it feels to be celebrated and so on, and I wrote this poem in response. It's called Success. I can feel the thick yellow fat of applause building up in my arteries, friends. Yet I go on a fool for adoration. Do I care that when it sloughs off, it is likely to go straight to the brain? I am already showing the first signs of poetic aphasia, the words coming hard, the synapses of metaphor no longer connecting. But look at me, down on my knees next to the podium, lapping the last drops, then rolling in the stain like a dog. Getting the smell in my good tweed sport coat, the grease on my suede elbow patches, and for what? Well, for the women I walk past the next morning, the ones in the terminal wheeling their luggage, looking so beautifully earnest, all for the hope that they will suddenly dilate their nostrils, squeeze the hard carry-on handles, and rise to the ripening odor of praise with which I have basted myself stinking to heaven. So that's sort of how it is. I was asked to talk about my first year, and it is a blur of public events. I recently had to write a couple of paragraphs for the Library of Congress's newsletter, sort of summarizing what I'd done in the first year, and I began to count up the public appearances I'd made, and I stopped rather early in the spring at 50, and I thought that was enough to mention, you know. But I've been working pretty much 7 days a week. The Poet Laureateship really requires very little of you. If you wanted to do the minimum amount of things, that would amount to about 6 appearances in Washington, including an opening reading that I would give, and then a closing speech in May at the end of the term, plus inviting some people in for various things like that. That's all you'd really have to do. But in recent years, they've hoped that the Poet Laureate would act as a sort of public relations officer for the Library of Congress and get out there and try to generate interest in poetry and so on. And I took this on with a vengeance. I have been doing it night and day ever since I was appointed. And one of the things that's very important for me is that I want to prove that someone from out here in the great American desert can do this job better than anybody else. And it seems to be working rather well. You know, I I've had lots and lots of support. And this newspaper column that Doug mentioned, I hope if you know people who are people who might be on the editorial staffs of weekly papers, small independent papers, I hope you'll tell them about this because it's free. We are now in the last formal report I had was a couple of months ago. The woman who keeps the statistics is on maternity leave, and nobody else knows how to get into the computer to get this information. But at that time, we had about 9 million readers, potential readers, and we were in about just a little under 100 newspapers. And I would guess by now we're at 150 papers, probably 11 or 12 million potential readers. We're starting to get, the Omaha World Herald has my column, the Lincoln Journal Star. So we're in Nebraska, there are a number of papers. But we've also recently had the Christian Science Monitor's picked it up, which was very pleasing to me because they've always run poetry in there, and I was kind of surprised that they would want to add even more. But that's been one of my big efforts throughout the year. I would say that the event at which I had the most fun this year was on the 9th of March. I invited the folk singer John Prine to meet me on stage at the Coolidge Auditorium at the Library of Congress and talk about writing folk songs. And that is also available at the Library of Congress's website if any of you are old John Prine fans. It was a magnificent time. The two of us were on for about an hour and a half, and I would ask a question, and John would play a little something. And no poet laureate had invited a folk singer to the Library of Congress since 1936 when Woody Guthrie was there. So it was a big event, and we had a lot of people who came. And that site or that section of the Library of Congress's website has had more hits than anything else they've done this year, which is really quite remarkable. And for those of you who don't know John Prine's work, he could be compared to Bob Dylan. I think he's really a better writer than Dylan, and been very interesting. I wanted to do this once, and now, of course, I'm getting CDs from people all over the country who think that they should come. And the other day, I had to turn down Arlo Guthrie. I felt really badly about that. So at any rate, those are some of the things I've been doing. Lots of travel. I've been all over the country, back and forth. Many events at which, the standard poetry reading on university campuses. While I enjoy those, they really do nothing to extend the audience for poetry because all the people who are there are already reading poetry and following it. So I'm trying to do other things. I recently was at a conference called Writing the Medical Experience, which was for people who had suffered illnesses of one kind or another who wanted to write, along with some medical staff who were also writers. Richard Seltzer, the surgeon, was there, who's written some books, was there on the faculty with me. And I really liked that because it was a completely fresh, new audience. Last night, I was telling Doug in Lincoln, I spoke to two groups. One, people with various mental illness and drug problems who are interested in trying to write their way out of that. That was for a couple of hours. And right after that, I met with the families of National Guard, Nebraska National Guard members who want to write about their experience with their loved ones being in Iraq. And it was really a touching thing for me. It's one thing to see these people on TV in the evening, being interviewed when they lose somebody, but to be in a room full of them who are all really suffering from this thing, it was really a powerful experience. So I'm trying to do venues like that. I've been talking to lots of librarians. I went to the National Council of Teachers of English meeting last year in November, and I spent 4 days just talking to English teachers in the halls. English teachers are really on the front line when it comes to poetry in this country as far as getting people enthusiastic about it, so I want to spend more time with them. I'm going back this year in November, the convention's in Pittsburgh. I'm going to be there for that. we have a lot of marvelous teachers in this country, and that NCTE convention is an example. Here are 7,500 people who have come there and are paying $200 a night for hotel rooms that their schools will not support, that they've come there on their own because they want to be there. And every one of them that I talked to about poetry had at least one good idea for me, you know. And so I'm trying to figure out some way of assembling all these so that if you're teaching Robert Frost Stopping by Wood on a Snowy Evening, you know, you could punch this up and all these ideas would come up for you and so on. I spent time at the American Library Association meeting in Chicago talking to librarians. There, again, is a whole field of people who are very important when it comes to getting poetry back in front of people. I might talk a little bit about what I think happened to poetry in the 20th century. Now, this is not coming from a literary theorist or any. This is just me sort of gossiping about things. But until about 1920, there was an enormous audience for poetry in this country, and it had come through the century before. People loved poetry; they memorized it. I would guess that many of you in here have grandparents who could recite lots of poems by heart that they learned in schools and so on. And then along came the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs on of poetry, Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, who fell upon it and began to convey the idea that poetry had to be very learned, that it was for a learned class of people, and an elite class, although that's my word for it. And so poetry began to drift sort of in that direction because Eliot and Pound were very influential writers. William Carlos Williams was on the other side saying that he wanted to write poetry that dogs and cats could read. And he sort of got shunted aside in the 20th century as a result of this. Well, in the wartime years, at about the time that abstract expressionism in painting was gaining its power, the critics, the art critics and the literary critics, began to ascend in power and began to establish reputations and help people get good jobs and so on. Now, a literary critic is an interpreter or an art critic, and their work is in interpreting. And so they will gravitate toward work that is in need of interpretation. And they like to have something that they can work on, you know. So what happened was that the poets began writing for the critics and making their work in need of interpretation. I don't know that anybody really ever consciously thought this out or did it intentionally. My guess is that, sure, some of them did, you know, but others were just sort of following the trend. And so poetry's drifted way off in this direction of being, you know, extremely difficult for a popular audience to understand, increasingly complicated, discouraging, frankly, and intimidating for a lot of people. But all along there's been a strain of American poetry, and I'm a part of that, that where you really wanted to write poems that people could understand. I'm an heir to that William Carlos Williams plain American that dog and cats can read. And so what I'm doing to this newspaper column is I'm finding poems in that category, and I'm putting them out in front of American readers saying, here's a poem. It's a good poem, but it's something you're going to be able to understand. And I have been delighted with the response I've had. I have not done a single event this last year where somebody didn't come up to me afterwards and say, you know, some guy with his thumbs in his belt, you know, comes up and says, you know, my wife dragged me to this thing tonight, and I don't like poetry, and I never have liked it, but I think I'm going to give it a try now, you know. So, I mean, that kind of thing is really wonderful for me. It's been a great experience. I'm gonna quit talking here in a minute, but I want to read a poem that today would have been my mother's birthday. She was born in 1908, so that would make her, she would have been 97. She died in March of 1998, and a month after she died, I wrote this poem, which is in Delights and Shadows, as a sort of letter to her. Mother. Mid-April already, and the wild plums bloom at the roadside, a lacy white against the exuberant, jubilant green of new grass and the dusty, fading black of burnt-out ditches. No leaves, not yet, only the delicate, star-petaled blossoms, sweet with their timeless perfume. You have been gone a month today and have missed three rains and one night-long watch for tornadoes. I sat in the cellar from 6 to 8 while fat spring clouds went somersaulting, rumbling east. Then it poured, a storm that walked on legs of lightning, dragging its shaggy belly over the fields. The meadowlarks are back, and the finches are turning from green to gold. Those same two geese have come to the pond again this year, honking in over the trees and splashing down. They never nest, but stay a week or two, then leave. The peonies are up, the red sprouts burning in circles like birthday candles, for this is the month of my birth, as you know, the best month to be born in, thanks to you, everything ready to burst with living. There will be no more new flannel nightshirts sewn on your old black singer, no birthday card addressed in a shaky but businesslike hand. You ask me if I would be sad when it happened, and I am sad. But the iris I moved from your house now hold in the dusty, dry fists of their roots, green knives and forks as if waiting for dinner, as if spring were a feast. I thank you for that. Were it not for the way you taught me to look at the world, to see the life at play in everything, I would have to be lonely forever. Maybe one more here. Then we can do some questions. About 2 months after my mother died in 98, the University of Nebraska Medical Center right here in Omaha saved my life. I had stage 4 cancer, came up here, and have been doing well since. They got it. And I wrote this poem about the waiting room out here at the Lead Cancer Center. At the cancer clinic, this is really about the whole spirit of healing, I think, and the tremendous affirmation that fighting illness is. I sat in these oncology waiting rooms with people who were almost beatific in their kind of glowed with their desire to live. You know, there are people, of course, who've given up and gone home, but the people who are there are fighting hard. At the cancer clinic. She is being helped toward the open door that leads to the examining rooms by two young women I take to be her sisters. Each bends to the weight of an arm and steps with the straight, tough bearing of courage. At what must seem to be a great distance, a nurse holds the door, smiling and calling encouragement. How patient she is in the crisp white sails of her clothes. The sick woman peers from under her funny knit cap to watch each foot swing scuffing forward and take its turn under her weight. There is no restlessness or impatience or anger anywhere in sight. Grace fills the clean mold of this moment, and all the shuffling magazines grow still. So thank you. Well, let's have a few questions now.
Thank you very much for that presentation. And beginning with the questions, please write them down. Gary's going to walk around and pick them up. And we will start with a question. How does one become the Poet Laureate of the United States?
Well, it's a great mystery. The Poet Laureateship and all the literary programs at the Library of Congress are funded not by tax money, but by private endowment money. There's no relationship to the government other than the fact that the that the Poet Laureate's office is housed at the Library of Congress, really. The Librarian of Congress, who currently is James Billington, a distinguished Russian historian, chooses the Poet Laureate based upon input I would gather from close personal associates and staff and so on. And I found out after I'd been appointed that they'd actually been looking at me for a couple of years and calling around and so on. And there were people in Omaha who were called. I believe Mike Yanni was called. People who are not necessarily literary people at all, but who, you know, are influential people and who might be able to make some sort of an assessment of how the Poet Laureate might perform. That's about as much as I know about it. A couple of weeks before I got the call, I got a call from a poet in Kansas who said the Library of Congress called and was asking some questions about you. And I said, well, that's because I'm going to the National Book Fair in Washington, and they're probably just, the Bush administration is probably worried about who's going to be there, you know. So I thought no more about it. You know, that came after Laura Bush had invited the poets to the White House, and then there's this big stink about Sam Hamill, you know, intended to go there and demonstrate, you know, and so on. So that whole thing had fallen through, but I figured, well, they were just being very extra careful. So I didn't think any more about it, and then I got the call one night, and that's it. That's really all I know.
What the other question is, what prompted you to begin writing poetry?
Girls. It was all about girls. I think this is true of lots and lots of people in the arts, that it's a way of, if you can't do anything else, as I couldn't, I wasn't big enough to play football. I wasn't tall enough to play basketball. I wasn't fast enough to run in the track. I couldn't play a musical instrument or anything like that. And I was looking at Life magazine one day, and I saw this picture of grizzled old John Berryman with all these beautiful young co-eds encircling him. And I thought, well, you know, maybe, you know. So, yeah, that was the motivation. But I have graduate students who are still into that. I can see it all over them, you know.
As a professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, did you have Tommy Lee in your English class?
I did not, I'm sorry to say. I think that Harvey's idea to have Tommy Lee down there was a marvelous idea. I think it's going to really pay off in spades.
The question is, will you please read for us The Old People on page 13?
Request time. It's kind of fun. The old people. Pant scuffs rolled and in old shoes, they stumble over the rocks and wade out into a cold river of shadows far from the fire, so far that its warmth no longer reaches them. And its light, but for the sparks in their eyes when they chance to look back, scarcely brushes their faces. Their ears are full of night, rustle of black leaves against a starless sky. Sometimes they hear us calling and sometimes they don't. They are not searching for anything much, nor are they much in need of finding something new. They are feeling their way out into the night, letting their eyes adjust to the future.
Do you know what page that one is on? I don't know. The next question is, since you read your mother poem, would you read Father? And I'm a gardener, so perhaps Last Tomato. Thank you.
This poem about my father begins rather inappropriately, but you'll see that I take a quick turn to recover as it goes on. This was on, I wrote this on May 19, 1999, which was, May 19th was his birthday. Father. Today you would be 97 if you had lived, and we would all be miserable. You and your children driving from clinic to clinic, an ancient, fearful hypochondriac and his fretful son and daughter, asking directions, trying to read the complicated, fading map of cures. But with your dignity intact, you have been gone for 20 years, and I am glad for all of us, although I miss you every day, the heartbeat under your necktie, the hand cupped on the back of my neck, Old Spice in the air, your voice delighted with stories. On this day each year, you love to relate that at the moment of your birth, your mother glanced out the window and saw lilacs in bloom. Well, today, lilacs are blooming in side yards all over Iowa, still welcoming you. I don't have the last tomato along. The last tomato hasn't been published other than it was in that television program where a lot of people saw it, so I don't have that one with me. Sorry.
Your newspaper project is fantastic. Readership of newspapers has declined. Young people don't tend to read the newspaper. They are on the Internet. Question, do you have any plans for taking this project to the web to reach younger potential poets?
Well, you know, it is on the web. It is, if you search under poetry, you can find it that way. My guess is that a number of people have found it already. Verse Daily and Poetry Daily and all those things are web publications, and they're doing a really good job. It's a similar thing that I'm doing. Garrison Keillor, Writer's Almanac, he and I are kind of working the same side of the street on this thing. So my guess is that a number of young people will find it just by doing searches and so on. And, it may very well be that we're able to publicize it a little more in various ways in coming months. I'm not sure.
Has the knowledge that your audience of readers has grown since last year made it more difficult or easier to sit down and write something that will go out to the world?
I try to write every day. When I was still at the insurance company all those years, I would write from 4:30 in the morning till 7 every morning and then get up and get ready to go to work. And I still do that. I still am up at 4:30 and try to write till 7. But I'm not writing anything that I care much about right now. There's a lot of pressure on me and lots of mail and correspondence and so on. And I have kind of decided I would just sort of put that aside while I'm doing this work and concentrate on this job instead. And I have written some poems, that success poem I wrote, in the recent months, and that sort of thing. But, yeah, it is harder. And also one of the things that I didn't foresee that has happened is that, for years and years, like any other writer, I would send my work out, and some would be rejected, and some would be accepted and everything. And all of a sudden I discover that anything that I write right now, I could write something right here in front of you and it would get published, And I don't want that to happen, so I've quit sending my work out altogether. I'm not going to send any work out for at least a couple of years just because I don't want things being published just because they've got my name on them, and I don't trust them myself, frankly, to know well enough which ones I really want to be represented by, So I've avoided doing that and similar things. I also have made a statement that I wouldn't write any blurbs for the back of books or any letters of recommendation or any of that stuff while I'm doing it. And so I'm trying to keep apart from it a little.
The question is, how can a novice start writing poetry? And I would add, without looking at girls first.
Well, that question sort of suggests that this novice is going to write finished poems and complete poems. I'm trying to encourage people just to be writing, to just every day try to write a little something, I don't care if it's a letter, it's a paragraph out of a short story, a little snatch of a poem. It's the process that's important. And if you show up for work every day, something good will happen. That's what it takes. It's just the discipline of actually trying to write a little something every day, and let it be a journal. Those of you who have kept journals have surprised yourself. I'll bet every one of you who keeps a journal has sometimes surprised yourself with something that's popped into your head while you were writing. And that's the kind of thing you're looking for by writing every day. But the one thing we can do with younger people, little children, is to show them that poetry can be a lot of fun. Show them the poems that are fun to read. And you know, somebody told me last night that when they were small, they memorized Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky poem. You know, it makes no sense to anybody. You know, I mean, there are literary critics who make a lot of sense out of it, but the rest of us, it makes no sense to. But it's great fun to read. It has a lot of wonderful noise, and anything like that that we can show little kids will get them interested, I think.
Other than yourself, who do you consider to be the current poets to read?
Oh, you know, there are so many really marvelous poets in this country. They, like me, don't write well every day, and I suppose my personal poetry library at home is 4,000 or 5,000 volumes, and I have slips of paper in all those books at points where I want to go back and look at those poems again. And there are some books that have only one that I like. There's some books that don't have any that I've kept just because I want to go back and look at them again sometime. Right now I'm especially taken with the poetry of Jane Hirschfield, who lives in California, is really a terrific poet. I've got one of her poems coming up in the column. Nancy Willard is another poet whose work I like a great deal, and she lives at Poughkeepsie, New York, and teaches at Vassar. But I hesitate to start naming them because there's so many that I like.
Can you tell us your favorite John Prine song?
Well, the one that I think says, there are many that say wonderful things about Prine's outlook on the world. One of the things that I like about him is that he has a tremendous respect for ordinary people. He has a song that the refrain is, "There's a big old goofy guy dancing with a big old goofy girl. Oh Lord, it's a big old goofy world." If that line came out of 90% of the singers in the country, it would come out as a sneer. Out of John Prine, it comes out, you know, he is one of those goofy guys, and that's the difference. He is so respectful of just ordinary humans in every way. I just love that about his work, and they're marvelous songs, all of them. This new album of his called Fair and Square is a real honey.
How would you generate interest in poetry to young people, elementary and junior high school students?
Well, here again, I sort of answered that. It's mainly about showing them that it should be fun, that poetry can be playful, because if that's a good experience at that age and we can kind of nourish that and they can understand that poetry is going to be fun, they'll stick with it the rest of their lives. If we make poetry an assignment that they have to ferret out the one meaning in the poem and that only the teacher knows the meaning, and if you don't get it, you flunk, then people get out of high school and they see a poem and they say, "I took that course. I don't have to do that anymore. You know, I'm not going to mess with that." You know, and that's what we have to do. You know, we have to encourage the idea that it is something that's pleasurable and can touch us.
As poet laureate, have you been able to read at, and I'm quoting from the question here, or heck, compete in any poetry slams? What do you think of poetry slams?
I think poetry slams are a good thing. I have never participated in one. One of the things we need to think about in, you know, we tend to talk about American poetry as if it were one big thing, and it really is not. It is a series of intact, thriving communities. They're the cowboy poets, they're the slam poets, they're the literary poets, they're the spoken word poets, and each of those communities is having a perfectly good time. Last year I called up the National Cowboy Poets Festival in Elko, Nevada, and I said, "I was just appointed the Poet Laureate of the United States, and I'd sort of like to come to your meeting in January in Elko." And their response was, "So what?" You know? And I really think that was marvelous, because, you know, they are perfectly happy doing what they're doing. They're having a great time, you know, and they don't want the nation's literary head of the nation's literary poets to be out there messing with them, you know. It's very interesting. All these communities are, as I said, very healthy, and they are enjoying themselves immensely, and they have wonderful social gatherings and that kind of thing. And of them all, it is only the literary poets who think that everyone should be writing like them. You know, the cowboy poets don't say the slam poets should be writing cowboy poetry, you know, and so on. But each of these communities is very healthy, I think.
How can you write your way out of problems?
Well, a problem is a kind of cluster of disorder. And if you can create some kind of order, there's an assurance in that. After September 11th, there were tens of thousands of poems on the internet. People writing about all the buildings falling and all that kind of thing. They turned to poetry for some reason. And I think it's because if you can make a little rectangle of words on a piece of paper and do it as well as you possibly can, you have established a small piece of order against great disorder and chaos. And I think that's true of any kind of writing. If you know, journaling is good for that. It helps us clarify our minds. E.M. Forster, the great British novelist, said, "How do you know what you know till you see what you say?" And there's a lot to that, I think.
Do you see increased interest in poetry among young people?
Well, you know, I don't know that I can conclude anything. You know, the young people that have been at events of mine are obviously interested. The schools that I've attended, gone to visit, you know, they're very interested in poetry. It may be because I'm there, and maybe when I'm not there, they're not all that interested. You know, I'm somebody new, you know, a new experience and so on. But I do think young people naturally like poetry. It's just that we have systematically tried to destroy that in them in one way or the other over the years.
What do fine poets talk about when they get together?
Girls and boys. Those two things, I think. And other poets, you know. Yeah.
Was it you who wrote the poem in the 70s saying, "Don't leave your poems laying around when people come over to talk to me about poetry"?
I think I did write that, but frankly, I can't remember it. I just remember it just vaguely.
In your role as poet laureate, what influence have you had in getting President Bush to read and enjoy poetry?
None.
And the next question, is there a politics of poetry?
There is a politics of poetry, and it's because there are good jobs to be had on university campuses teaching poetry. And as a result, some of those jobs might pay, you know, for a professor, it'd be good salary to make $200,000 a year. And wherever there's money out there, there's political influences of one kind or another at work. And that's the politics. It's the politics of manipulation and influence and that sort of thing, I think more than anything else.
How do you see the internet influencing writing in general, poetry in particular?
I think the internet is probably, email is probably not good for writing. For some reason or other, it seems to be very sloppy to me. I get all kinds of emails, and it's very, you know, thrown down. I also don't like the fact that it is so easy to be rude in email, you know, without even really intending to be. You know, you're in a hurry, you're dashing off something, and you send it off before thinking about it, and so on. One of the things that this is a curiosity that I'm very interested in, but William Burroughs, who was one of the beat writers who lived in Lawrence, Kansas in his last years, discovered one time, looking at one of his typewritten manuscripts, that all of the strong words appeared on the left-hand side of the page. The verbs and nouns were almost always on the left-hand side of the page because, he said, when you threw the carriage, then you re-attacked the keyboard after you'd moved the carriage, and you came down with the strong words. And so he cut his manuscripts in half and then took their left half and then rewrote that with the strong language in it. Now, that was true of the typewriter, and I think that was probably a really keen observation of his. What happens when you're typing on a terminal is that it just automatically wraps. So it's my guess that in a couple of 300 years, when somebody looks back at the prose being written today as opposed to the prose being written pre-computer, that they'll be able to see differences in it, I think, because of this. It'll have a different kind of a rhythm to it, I think.
With your busy schedule, do you still find time to write? And has it changed your focus at all?
Well, I kind of answered that in that I really am not doing much writing at all. And as to change of focus, I'm still looking for the same kind of poems I was always looking for. I try to spend a lot of my time paying attention to things. Most of us go through entire days without paying attention to anything. We pull into the garage at night, we can't remember a single thing we saw on the way home. And it's very important for writers particularly to try to pay attention to things. So Linda Gregg, who's a poet whose work I admire a great deal, she has her students notice 6 things a day. So that's a discipline that I try to do, and it is very hard to notice 6 things a day. It sounds so simple, but it really is very difficult to do that. And if you can do that, then you have things to write about and so on.
Where do you find your inspiration to write poetry?
I think that here's a little definition that I've kind of been playing around with. I think that a poem is the record of some kind of a discovery. It can be a discovery in the world, something you notice. It can be a discovery in memory. Or it can be a discovery within the language itself, something that when you're writing in this process, you're working in your journal or you're writing a letter, the combination of a couple words will trigger something. What I'm watching for always are those little events that will sort of spring forward into something that I can kind of tease around into a poem. I have never had an idea for a poem. Poems don't work that way for me, and I think most of us. An idea is something. John Milton had an idea for Paradise Lost. Matthew Arnold had ideas, but most of us don't have ideas. If you start with an idea like, I am going to write a poem about how horrible the war in Afghanistan is, you're not going to be able to write it, because what you have to do is you have to proceed from some detail forward. The very best poem that I saw about September 11th was written by a guy named Dennis Nirksey, who lives in Brooklyn. And here everyone is writing these poems about the towers collapsing and the clouds of dust and all the enormity of this thing. And they were all very nebulous and general and everything. Nirksey wrote a poem about the cadaver dogs and how depressed the dogs got because they couldn't find any bodies, and how the firemen would go hide in the rubble so the dogs could find them to bring the dogs back and everything. That's the kind of detail you've got to go for, I think. Something very small at the foot of all that chaos, some detail. And there was one detail in there about teaching the dogs by having them sniff a button, just a button, that tiny little thing against all that enormity, that little detail, and it's so evocative of the whole experience. And that's the kind of thing that that I'm looking for all the time.
So, what do you do next?
Let's see. I go to the tomorrow afternoon. I go to the Nebraska State Fair to be a poet at the arts and the opening sort of art auction thing. I'm going to do that, and then Lord knows what's. I try not to look more than about a day or two ahead on my schedule. It's pretty daunting, so. But it'll be more of the same.
I have one last question. Does anyone else have anything that they would like to ask? The last question, or it's actually not a question, it's a statement, but Nancy Baldwin Carter says to tell you right on. Thank you very much, Mr. Ted Kuzma. That was a wonderful presentation.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speaker has been Ted Kuzer, Poet Laureate of the United States. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, August 25th, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Gary Kerr for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be Friday, September 23rd at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a debate between John McKeel, superintendent of the Omaha Public Schools, and Keith Lutz, superintendent of the Millard Public Schools. They'll talk about the proposed Omaha Public Schools takeover of several schools in Millard and Ralston. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.